Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everybody. We didn't introduce ourselves last time.
Did we not?
No.
How did people know who we were?
I have no idea.
I often forget who I am.
I frequently think I'm you.
Really?
Yeah. I'm Andrew Leyland.
I'm Michael Leyland.
And we host this show.
We do host this show.
Hey Kids Comics, which is all about comics, hey. Not about kids. Because we don't really like kids.
Yeah.
We're not overly fond of them, as a rule.
I mean, that's for Hey Comics Kids.
Hey Comics Kids.
Yeah, I heard that they're into kids. In a not a weird way, at least.
I hope it's not a weird way.
I think it's a weird way.
I hope it's not a weird way in any way whatsoever.
We're not here to talk about kids. We're here to talk about comics.
Good, because I don't know a lot about kids. I know lots about comics.
You had three.
It don't mean I know anything. you are aware, right? We just made it up as we went along.
Well, there were those few years. I mean...
Like 20 of them.
You said you would go out for a pack of fags, and it was a good 5 years until I saw you again.
You thought this was especially weird because I don't smoke.
Yes, so we are going to do a show today.
We are.
But also, we didn't do one last time, but I think we are going to bring back our segment of... What in the world is going on in the Clone Saga?
Which
is a working title. I'm sure a better one will.
Oh, no, that's a great title. What in the world is going on in the Clone Saga? Where in the world is Ben Reilly, San Diego?
Ben Reilly, San Diego.
Or whatever his name was. Okay, we're going to look at Clone Saga. We can't call it Chronicles because there was a podcast called Clone Saga Chronicles.
Right.
So we don't want to infringe upon anyone's copyright. But
let's just say we're a clone.
When last we met, lovely listeners, I had talked about how Sensational Spider-Man Zero had completely revamped the strip and Dan Jurgens coming aboard had give it some urgency and some energy and whatever.
Right.
And this continues.
Okay.
This continues into Tom DeFalco's relaunch of The Amazing Spider-Man, which he does with Mark Bagley, so it looks nice.
Mm-hmm.
Bagley's art doesn't look rushed or crappy anymore because it's not.
He's been
given time to do it properly. It's an interesting issue. Because it's dealing with the fact that Ben Reilly's has been gone for 5 years, so he doesn't know that the relationship with the Human Torch has become a buddy-buddy friendship.
Okay.
So he still, like, treats Johnny like, you know, shit on his shoe. He doesn't know the Sandman's reformed.
Right.
So he's meeting up with the new Sandman for the first time. He doesn't know what the relationship with Silver Sable is.
Okay.
This was all stuff that Peter Parker did. So all that's quite interesting. And it's a genuinely good issue. Lots of subplots set up. Who's this Jessica girl?
Right.
Who's encroaching upon Peter's taking pictures for the Bugle thing. Silver Sable, who's basically just a 90s bad girl.
So are these all things that we know, but Ben doesn't?
Yeah, Ben doesn't know it.
Right.
Ben's never met Silver Sable,
yeah.
Whereas Peter has a relationship with Silver Sable and Sable International.
Okay.
Peter is well aware that Sandman's gone straight.
Yeah.
So all brilliant issue. Genuinely good. And this carries on into Howard Mackie and John Romita Jr., who are doing Spider-Man.
Right.
Which is what it's called now. Brilliant art from John Jr. at the pinnacle of his powers here, I think, before he went over to DC, and it kind of sucked. The story in this isn't as good. It seems like Howard Mackie's writing a slightly different character than Tom DeFalco and Dan Jurgens, and you've got the thing that Howard Mackie was very big at throwing things at the wall and seeing what stuck,
right?
And often forgetting the things that he'd thrown at the wall when they hit the wall and bounced off and rolled under a table, and he forgot all about them. But it's carried by John Jr.'s art, but there's nothing quintessentially Ben Reilly about it. As you can see by flicking through the pages, it is mostly Ben Spider-Man.
Okay.
And it could easily be a Spider-Man story. Doesn't matter who's under the mask. And then it falls off a cliff.
It was going so well for so long. Something had to happen.
Yes. We go back to these pointless Web of Scarlet Spider interludes.
Okay.
Where we've now got a scenario where this guy in the Scarlet Spider outfit is somebody who's been affected by a virtual virus from being in the virtual insanity world of the last issue, and he keeps glitching and becoming like a computer type thing. And I've got to be brutally honest with you, I lost interest.
Okay.
And it becomes a New Warriors issue. Yeah. Don't care. No disrespect to the people involved in this, Evan Skolnick and Pat Zercher. Pat Zercher does Conan.
Right.
Now,
okay.
Absolutely brilliant, no problem with any of that, but I just did not care about any of this, and I wanted to carry on reading the story that I was reading, and I came to an interesting realisation. this didn't happen originally because I didn't buy any of these. I was back reading the regular books, so that was interesting, but I wasn't reading any of these add-ons. And that goes to what we've talked about, that if somebody comes along and wrote a novel of this,
yeah,
and cut all of the extraneous material, none of that would be in there.
Yeah.
It'd all be gone because it's completely irrelevant. The Fourth Spider-Man Boot, The Spectacular Spider-Man by writer Todd DeZergo and Sal Buscema is fine. As is normal when you get a series that has four interlocking titles, there's always one or two that are better than others.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. It's not that this is a bad story. It's very reminiscent of Denny O'Neill's story with the where Sandman and Hydro Man got merged into one blob.
All right, okay.
It's very reminiscent of that. It's fine. But then it's interrupted again by a two-parter Spider-Man Punisher family plot.
Yeah.
And this is not good.
It seems like it's the one-offs and minis,
yeah,
that are the
they're
worst.
Irrelevant. Yeah. They're not necessary. So a plowed through family plot. Again, if you were turning this into a novel, this would be cut.
Right.
Absolutely nothing of interest happens here. It's a Punisher story. The only interesting thing is Tombstone's in it. And
okay.
Tombstone relates to the current Spider-Man book. By and large, it's I don't care. It's crappy. And I stopped there before we had to record this time. And it's another interlude. It's a four-part Venom miniseries called Along Came a Spider.
Right.
So, again, whether that is in any way a Ben Reilly story, or it's a Venom story with Ben Reilly in, I'm willing to bet the latter. But as you can see from the back cover, this just keeps happening. You've got the three-part Media Blizzard story, and then it's interrupted by a Christmas special and the Spider-Man Final Adventure miniseries, which was not as final as we were led to believe. And then Spider-Man Unlimited, and then another shot, and then back to the main book. And it's every time they start building up a head of steam, something cuts them off at the knees. And it's not like Nightfall or Death of Superman, where you could read them all, and it just keeps building on the main story. It just keeps being interrupted. But I was reading Life of Ryla, again, well worth checking out if you're reading along with me, or reading the Clone Saga in these omnibuses. Life of Ryla's brilliant. And it said they did come up with an idea whereby both of them would be real.
Right.
So there was a time travel story put in place where Peter is sent back in time, if I'm remembering this correctly, with no memories. Ben Reilly is sent back in time with no memories. He lives his life as Peter Parker. And then when we get to the main, I'm probably butchering what this was, but when we get back to the main timeline, there's not two of them anymore. He's gone back in time. Time has caught up with itself. There's only the one left.
Right.
The explanation of it was better.
Okay. Right.
The other one they came up with, and I liked this one.
Okay.
Because it solved all of the problems. They learned that Ben is the clone. Mm. Peter's the real deal. Mary Jane, also a clone.
So they can both have their own Mary Jane.
No.
Right.
So what they would do with it was Ben would, you know, die of clone degeneration or whatever. They'd get him off the table somehow.
Yeah.
It was never really ironed out what they would do. But what would happen was he would find the real Mary Jane still in stasis somewhere, along with all the other people that he cloned.
Okay.
And kept the real one out the way. The clone of Mary Jane suffers clone degeneration. She never existed.
Yeah.
They were never married.
Right.
The strip can go back to where it was before the Clone Saga even happened.
Okay.
And they would move on from that point and never mention it again.
How fuming would you be, though, if after sticking with the Clone Saga, they then just go, ha, none of it happened.
Well, it still happened.
Yeah.
But they would just move forward from that point. Peter was never married to Mary Jane because it wasn't Mary Jane. Mary Jane's come out of this status 5 years in suspended animation with no memories whatsoever of what's happened.
Right.
She's going to go back and pick up her life and carry on with what she was doing.
Yeah.
Not married to Peter. And they can carry on, though, with the decks have been completely cleared. Now, I know what you're thinking, and you're right. But if you look at it from their point of view, after everything that's gone on and everything they've had to put up with, to actually just be able to clear the decks completely, have an issue where Peter makes peace with what's happened and just gets on with his life.
Yeah.
And how he has to explain that to Jonah and Aunt May. Oh, well, Aunt May's dead, isn't she? But all that stuff, how he gets past that, that would be an issue. And then they just go forward. And essentially, they're picking up from like Amazing Spider-Man, I don't know, 285 or whatever, before he proposed to her.
Yeah.
Never happened. And they just carry on from there.
What are the legal logistics of that? By like, By the way, I am still married, but the person I married doesn't exist.
Is a clone. Yeah. Yeah, so is he... Well, I don't think they'd have gone into that. Would he have to get a divorce? Would he have to get the marriage annulled? Do you think New York is used to this? So he goes into the marriage place. They must have one. Like, our council building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Explains the situation, and the woman behind the counter, or the man behind the counter, just goes, okay, whatever. Sign.
Yeah. I mean, this is the same place that only just got wheelie bins. Yeah, so they...
yeah, and it's kind of like, well, Galactus showed up. You had no problem believing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't believe that my wife was a clone who's not a clone. And,
Just imagine the Weekly World News. Yeah. I married a clone.
It's a Daily Bugle headline. And it's Peter talking about his own story. So anyway, I could see how that would have been attractive to them.
Mm.
That this just essentially wipes the slate back to before any of this happened.
Yeah.
They've not married. They've never been married because Mary Jane wasn't Mary Jane.
Yeah.
So she's no memories of this.
And I suppose in hindsight now, it's not really much different from what they would do with The One More Day, I guess.
Yeah, essentially.
I mean, they didn't know that at the time, I guess.
No, and it wouldn't have been the hard reboot that One More Day was.
Yeah.
It would have been like all of that still happened. Peter was still married to Mary Jane, but it wasn't Mary Jane and she has no memory of it.
Well, I guess that was similar to what Straczynski's One More Day was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That wasn't a hard reboot either, was
it? No. Whereas the One More Day, Brand New Day, One More Day, whatever it was, causes more problems than it solves.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you reread those old stories and you're like, okay, so they're not actually married here, they're just living together.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so why are they talking about marriage so much?
Yeah.
Marriage! Anyway, that's where I'm up to with Clone Saga. Hopefully, by next time we record, I'll have finished Ben Reilly Omnibus 1, Clone Saga Omnibus Volume 3.
Okay. And then you can do it all again.
And then I can do it all again with Volume 4. The fact that there is another volume of this to go through yet tells you everything you need to know.
I feel like you're not enjoying this, but you're committed. You're committed to the bit now. You're suffering for your craft.
Well, there is a little bit of that. But there's also... when it's good, it's actually quite interesting. There is a good story, though. There's an interesting story, though. There is a Death of Superman, a Batman Nightfall.
Yeah.
There is a... if they had refined it
and
kept the core purpose of it, it would have been much better. This is why I keep saying to you, I would like somebody, Marvel Publishing, to do this as a novel and do it properly.
Right.
Trim out all the fat, focus on the main parts of it, maybe do it as two novels, I don't know, but there is an awful lot of fat to be trimmed.
Yeah.
And you would need a competent editor and a competent writer to approach it from the angle as we are just going to streamline this. And everything that went nowhere, gone.
Yeah.
All the extraneous miniseries, gone. Everything that wasn't relevant, like the New Warriors stuff, gone. And just focus on the core story.
Yeah.
And see if it holds up as a narrative on its own. Because it is literally every time they make progress, they're cut off at the knees. Another pointless miniseries, another divergence into Scarlet Spider, another clone introduced. Because that's ultimately what killed the Mary Jane one.
Right.
We're introducing another clone. And what does that mean? Why did Professor Warren clone Mary Jane in the first place?
Yeah.
You've got all of those questions. And
But the computer clone. That was from the era where we were all deadly afraid of the ramifications of computers and the internet, wasn't it?
Whereas now we're all deadly afraid of AI.
Oh, yeah.
So nothing changes.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're doing we've got a couple of emails. Yes.
Okay.
Our first email tonight from Rob McCarthy. Number one, why Superman retellings turn into X-Men and other numbers. Number one, post Man of Steel and surely post Smallville, Superman always gets powers during puberty and screams, "Dear God, what am I?" I don't know that he screams. I don't know that he does that all X-Men people, the protecting the people that loathe me.
I do like the idea that every single Superman, he has to say that.
Dear God, what am I? He did get his powers at puberty in Smallville and Man of Steel, didn't he? But has that been retconned recently, hasn't it?
I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't either. The prisoner got studied more than Buffy when I was at school because Buffy didn't exist yet. Well, you didn't make that clear in the original email. I mean, that's implicit in the story, isn't it? Yeah, Buffy didn't exist yet. I mean, Buffy has had a lot of studies about the feminism of Buffy.
Yeah.
Interesting nowadays. But all of that is there. So, yeah, even if had my people would say, ooh, fantasy. Was it Buffy a fantasy? It got more fantastical once Glory showed up
and
you had the three morons with their ice machine. But I'm someone who firmly thinks the show should have ended at season three anyway. So, yeah. You know. And number three, Catwoman is the best bat foe for her own comic. She steals normal things. Well, they always have to be cat-related. Which is fine. That's good. Yeah, I'm don't mind with that. Mike Bailey emailed in again, because we always like Mike's emails. We like everybody's emails. If you want to be like Rob and Mike, email us in. Yeah. HeyKidsComics@virginmedia.com.
Don't have an email section if we don't have emails.
That's very true. Andy and Michael, very excited to hear your Garth Ennis Hellblazer omnibus. Of all your early episodes, some of my favourites were your Vertigo series, and more of that is always good. Originally, I was going to write in about how I appreciate your views on this material because you all are from the UK and have a completely different take on this material than this born and bred American. Imagine my surprise that my biggest takeaway was the bit at the end. Over the past few years, I've come to the conclusion that being a fan of something has a built-in expiration date. The date means different things to different people. For some, it's they have a favourite character that has continued to be published or put out in book or movie form, but the version that spoke to them the most is gone, and a newer version has replaced it. In other cases, it's a series you loved at one point in your life, and it really meant something to you, but now that you're older and had a bit more life experience, it doesn't quite feel the same. That's interesting, because that we did discuss that at the end.
Yeah.
That reading it now, I'm not 20 something anymore. Mm. You're not a kid. John very much comes across as someone I would have nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And even Garth Ennis has distanced himself a little bit from who John Constantine is.
Mm.
And it was interesting for me as well to point that out to Mike, to get to that conclusion and realise when I was writing that, the little notes to prompt what we talk about.
Yeah.
I was like, I wonder if Michael's going to agree with this or if he's going to love it as much as he ever did. And it was interesting to see you were kind of on the same page with it.
Yeah. And I think what else he's saying as well about how the version of what you like is not necessarily the same. I guess that's me with Invincible. The version of Invincible that I like is different from since the cartoon came out than the version that other people like as well.
And but you don't even watch the cartoon, do you?
I started watching it and I thought, this is not my version of these characters. This is not, I say mine, you know, as if it's that kind of entitlement that every fan seems to have now. But again, yeah, it's just, you know, we have the versions that we like. There's another version that other people are
My Star Trek is the first one and the Next Generation. And I can take or leave anything after that. But I'm not telling people who enjoy Discovery don't enjoy Discovery.
Yeah. Well, that's the maturity of it, isn't it? Yeah. Not holding on and gaslighting and demanding that studios make the things that you want to make. Like they're doing now. Did you see the movie studios are now going to work with...
Yes, Mike Bailey sent me that link.
Awful. Horrendous.
Yeah, terrible idea.
Terrible idea, yeah.
Absolutely shocking, because fans famously know what they want.
Yeah.
Famously always agree.
Who'd have thought... that when Rian Johnson came along and made the single greatest Star Wars film, at the very least, since The Phantom Menace, that it would have such huge ramifications on the rest of the media as a whole.
Yes. See, I think I liked The Last Jedi. I think The Last Jedi is pretty damn good.
Right.
It's easily the best film
of
that sequel trilogy. I would happily sacrifice it for a trilogy that made a lick of sense.
Yeah, but...
But it doesn't, so no, it doesn't. We are where we are.
And I absolutely just love the Star Wars film that essentially breaks the fourth wall and looks at you, the audience, and just goes, grow up, it's for kids. And at the time, I just thought, wow, this has broke Star Wars fans. You know, Star Wars fans don't know
and
what we want
now. It did.
It did. But I didn't know that it would not stop there, but it would just break the rest of the
it
movie
broke everything.
Business as well. Yeah. Genuinely amazing stuff.
Yeah. And it's quite staggering to watch it. And there is some element of... There is a discussion to be had. And there is... Are they getting it wrong? Is there a reason that Strange New Worlds, as a Star Trek thing, has been more embraced than the Kelvin films or Discovery or any of the other stuff? Why? What makes Strange New Worlds different that almost everybody who likes Star Trek kind of has embraced it? Some lesser extent than others. Mm. But it's kind of been... Well, essentially doing the original series, but now.
Yeah.
And what is it about that we've accepted? That we've accepted that it doesn't look like the 60s bridge, but it's not 1966 anymore.
Is it not just that it's still new enough to be new? It's not, Kirk's not showing up all the time and going, hey, remember me?
He is, though. Well,
but I think for me, and I've said this countless times, what's going, my big issue with Star Wars is that every single new Star Wars thing is, here's that character you like, here's at Tatooine again, here's how they're connected to something.
But important. The Acolyte wasn't that and still flopped.
I mean, the Acolyte had the audacity to involve women and people of colour.
You see, that's too easy an argument.
It is.
Was the Acolyte any good? And I would have to argue, no.
I wouldn't know, because again, the You've thing not watched is, it. I've not. I have no interest in watching. Just as I have no interest in watching Andor, just as I had no interest in watching Ahsoka.
Oh, Andor's fascinating.
I'm bored. Give me something new. Give me a Star Wars rom-com. Give me a Star Wars horror film. Stop giving me just the same old tap with a different coat of paint on it.
See, I think that ultimately the thing for me is everything that they've done since they bought it has been resolutely meh.
Yeah, yeah.
Across the board. I rewatched Solo last week, or the week before, and it's a perfectly fine pulp sci-fi adventure.
Yeah.
And people didn't like it because they'd recast Harrison Ford. And Rogue One is a perfectly fine science fiction war movie, which everyone seems to love, but me. I think that's fine, but I'm like, but did we need to see the story of stealing the plants?
We knew it happened. Yeah. That's
all we need to know. Yeah. The whole point of Star Wars is it starts and doesn't stop.
Yeah.
You've got to run to keep up with it. Once you fill in all that backstory, does it matter?
Yeah.
And there's people arguing, well, it fills a plot hole in the original Star Wars. No, it doesn't. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
The plans were stolen somehow. That's all you need to know. Go. And I've actually seen somebody, I sent you the screenshot of it. Didn't that? Somebody saying, you know, why did they not just get in the ships and leave instead of attack the Death Star? And I'm like, did you watch the film?
Yeah.
The whole point of the film was this was do or die.
Yeah.
They've gone to all that effort to steal the plans, to find a weakness, because if they don't stop it, more planets will blow up like Alderaan.
Yeah.
They have to. It's the line is here, no further. If they just go, oh, we're just going to run.
Yeah.
Well, how does that solve anything?
Again, said this many times before, media literacy or literacy of any kind is at an all-time low, it feels like, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that to me, that's the thing with Star Wars. It's that everything has been resolutely, it's fine. For me, that woman who got all that backlash because of Kenobi, Kenobi's my favourite one. Because at least it feels of a part of the rest of the saga. Because it's got Ewan McGregor in it, and it's got Hayden Christensen in it, and it's got Jimmy Smits in it, it at least feels part of the story.
It's still just very much a case of, I don't need to know what he was doing in
the little bits. You don't need to know, it's not important.
I'll be completely honest, I thought everyone in it was dull. Ewan McGregor was dull, she was dull, everyone in it was dull.
I quite liked her. My problem with it is everything looks the same.
It's a very bold statement, but you are removing the art from media. And love it or hate it, I know Megalopolis is the big one at the moment where a lot of people are saying, this is absolutely garbage, it's a horrible film, but it's art. This is one man's vision and he's put so much money into it. The worst thing you can do is ask the audience what they want. Because if the audience are doing what they want, the art in the first place is meaningless.
Mm.
An artist is not creating a piece that other people want to see. They're creating a piece that they want to see.
Mm.
What's the point of doing anything if you don't want to do it yourself? Mm. Anyone can throw paint on a canvas, but what are you saying? What are you conveying? What is it about?
It's like the Kevin Costner thing.
Yeah.
At least that's Kevin Costner's singular vision of that particular story, and he put his own money into it.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, whether it got one star or not,
it
was one creative vision from one director.
Yeah.
With everyone else helping him. Everyone else chips in, obviously.
And 100%. I mean, first of all, I'm biased because I saw that film in the cinema. Loved it. Outstanding film. Can't wait for part two to maybe come out.
It'll come out somewhere.
But these things, whether it's films or comics or books or TV shows or paintings or whatever, it's like people need to put their creative ideas out in the world more than companies need to bring back, say, a Wolverine versus Deadpool film that brings back these Fox characters that we pretend that we liked when we never actually did at the time.
Hmm.
These films shouldn't dominate cinemas. Francis Ford Coppola, whether you like him or whether you like the new film or whatever, a director of that level is struggling to make their passion project.
Hmm.
David Lynch, one of the biggest, most influential directors is not being greenlit to make films. Mm. And it's not new. Coppola and George Lucas had to convince and pay studios out of their own pocket for Akira Kurosawa to make films. Mm. And it's bizarre why these projects, these movies, are just disregarded for more and more slop. Disposable films, I guess, disposable media, and why people want more of that disposable media, why people want more familiarity, why people don't want the challenge, why genuinely huge names of directors and filmmakers are just being pushed to the side just so we can have more and more of this bright, colourful, loud noises that we just like to sit in front of and turn our minds off. And I don't know, because there is a time and a place for that. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with a mindless
film. We do a show about comics. That's disposable slop.
But I just... The needs to... We need more emphasis on the things that make life worth living a bit. What's the point of living in a world where we just don't have anything new, anything interesting, anything exciting? When was the last time you went to a film at the cinema that you were excited about? Like, we don't do it anymore. But
Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get off this topic in a minute and we'll move on. But this is what everyone's banging on about Agatha all along. It's brilliant. It's fantastic. Yeah. Everything I've seen, it's brilliant. It's fantastic. Right. But the problem is, Scott has got us Apple Plus.
Mm.
He shared it with us as part of friends and family.
Yeah.
So we've been watching Slow Horses.
Right.
And Slow Horses is so much better than Agatha all along on every conceivable level.
Yeah.
And you can say it's not fair to compare those two. They're completely different shows. But why is it not fair? Yeah. They're both expensive premium shows on expensive premium streaming services with expensive, well-known actors in. Why is it not fair to compare them? They're both genre pieces.
Yeah.
One's a spy piece, one's a science fiction piece, but they're both genre.
Yeah.
And yet Slow Horses reminds me of the first couple of scenes of Buffy.
Right.
When Buffy first started and just got better and better and better every week and made everything else on TV look sick.
Right.
Like, why can all genre television not be as good as this?
Yeah.
And that's what Slow Horses is. Why is every premium subscription service TV show not as good as this?
Yeah.
And it's basically made me go, I can't be bothered with this. I've watched two Agatha all along.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, it's not that. It's not as good as you're all saying it is.
Yeah.
Watch Slow Horses instead. It's proper, written by proper people.
Yeah.
It's about proper stuff. It's got great actors in it. And you know what? It doesn't look like it was filmed against a green screen.
I think I'd like to kind of finish on, to put all of my drowning flailings into an actual cohesive sentence.
Your point, and you do have one.
Yeah. Are you, or as a company, as a filmmaker, as a whatever, are you making something? Are you making a show? Are you making a film? Or are you making content?
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of things, and again, low-hanging fruit, but Disney want to make content.
Yeah, they just want more stuff for their streamer.
Warner Brothers want to make content, and I feel like we're getting more content than we're getting media, and I think that's ultimately the problem.
Mm. Well, somebody, I can't remember who it was, who the creative was, who said he kicked off in the middle of a meeting with somebody when they said content. He said, I don't make content, I make films.
Yeah.
It may have been Cameron. May have been James Cameron.
Right.
But I don't know. But James Cameron's got AI scrubbing all of his old films and making them look like crap. So what do we know? Anyway.
To finish off Michael's email.
Yes. I went through this with Jane Robertson's Starman. I read it when I was 25, and at the time it was one of the best things I'd ever read. I reread the first few arcs a year or so back, and I still enjoyed it, but Jack Knight hit different. I wasn't the guy in my mid-20s anymore, so reading about a guy in his early to mid-20s, figuring things out, read differently. It wasn't bad or good, it just is. Thank you for a great episode, Mikey might be. You are very, very welcome. Thank you, Rob and Michael, for emailing in with another email, and we'll get to it at the end. But we want to actually get to what we're talking about because we're 35 minutes into this show.
There's some trimming there to be done, surely.
Well, we'll see.
Right, so yes, today we're looking at Dragon Ball. I slapped the book because I have the actual book.
None of this digital filth.
None of this digital filth. By the time artist and writer Akira Toriyama was wrapping up his hugely successful manga, Dr. Slump, for Weekly Shonen Jump in 1984, he was already well underway with planning the book's successor. The follow-up would run all the way through to 1995 with a whopping 519 chapters. It would become a household name that rivaled even the popularity of Pokemon, would spawn countless sequels, spin-offs, games and movies. It would be the cause of political tension between Japan and Mexico.
Dr. Slumwood?
Dragon Ball.
Oh, right, sorry.
Well, I'll get to this. And, of course, have young boys in playgrounds across the world shouting out Kamehameha. It is, of course, Dragon Ball.
Mm.
So,
go on.
Dragon Ball Super.
Yeah.
So, in Latin countries, Dragon Ball's huge.
Yeah.
Genuinely massive. And for the season finale of Dragon Ball Super, there were watch parties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the distributors of Dragon Ball were very much like, watch it through official sources. Like, that's it. That's the only way. Mexico had a government-sponsored stadium watch party. They screened it semi-illegally in a stadium that sold out. The stadium was filled just to watch the season finale. And again, the distributors were like, that's very illegal. You should not be doing that. We are going to make that. And Mexico were like, nope, this is government funded. This is government sponsored. This elite, like the Mexico government were 100% behind an illegal watch party that sold out an entire stadium.
Bloody hell.
even Akira Toriyama himself would also become a huge name, and his distinct artistic style would lead him to be the lead concept designer for the Dragon Quest game series, as well as the beloved PlayStation 1 classic Chrono Trigger.
Did you play that?
I've never played Chrono Trigger. I'm a big fan of Dragon Quest. It absolutely cannot be overstated just how big of an impact Toriyama and Dragon Ball made on the world. Earlier this year, on March 1st, 2024, Toriyama sadly passed away at the age of 68.
That's no age, is it?
The impact of his death rippled across the world. There were tributes paid by countless manga artists, of course. Fans mourned and paid respects at the Bandai headquarters Goku statue in Japan, the Plaza de la Constitución in Mexico City, the Obelisco Monument in Argentina, and in Lima, Peru, 40 artists and fans painted a 6 meter high and 110 meter long mural in tribute. It's massive.
Wow.
French President Emmanuel Macron shared a piece of original art that he had signed by Toriyama that he'd once gifted him, and tributes were made by now former French Prime Minister Gabriel Attal, as well as the foreign ministries of China and El Salvador. I am not saying anything about the quality of leadership of Biden or at the time it would have been
Trump, wouldn't it?
For us, it would have been...
Who knows, for us, we've had Rishi, 16 prime ministers.
Would have been Rishi. Not to say anything about the political leaderships or the strength of our parties, but I didn't see any memorials or tributes coming from them.
None of them paid tribute to Son Goku?
Nope.
Would you have voted for him if he did?
Probably, yeah. It's just absolutely bizarre that like you've got actual world leaders paying respect and then, like, it's just... Yeah. But even covering the book today in the show was in direct response to Toriyama's passing. Like many others, when I heard the news of his death, it unlocked countless memories of the posters I'd have on my bedroom wall, of toys, of playing the Budokai Tenkaichi games with friends, you know, running around and pretending to fight and fly through the playground. But I'd never actually watched or read Dragon Ball before, so now it felt like the perfect time to.
Yeah, because Dragon Ball Z, which we'll get into in a future show, was what you watched.
Yeah.
Because you actually had two fish called Goku and Gohan.
I did, yeah. So, I mean, it's so there's a bit of a already, there's a question raised here. What's the difference between Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z? And we'll get to that in a little bit. Because we are getting ahead of ourselves just a little bit. And the inspiration for some of the biggest manga of our time, such as One Piece, Bleach and Naruto, and quite possibly one of the single most popular and influential mangas of all time, had humble beginnings.
Right, well, before you carry on, though, it's worth noting that this is starting to make significant impact here.
Right.
The BBC have bought One Piece.
Yes, it's all on iPlayer.
Yeah.
Which I was quite surprised at.
So, because I was like, should I give this a go? Because I very much enjoyed Blue-Eyed Samurai on Netflix. Oh, it was great.
Right.
And it's not really manga, but it kind of is. It's very inspired by it.
Yeah.
So I thought, should I give One Piece a go?
Well, I never got into One Piece because, again, it's huge.
Yeah.
But I remember when Toonami first got it and I was watching it new. This was, I was probably in primary school. One Piece is still going. It's
so when the iPlayer has got it all, they've not got it all.
They've not got it all, because I think it even says they've split it, similar to Dragon Ball, and I think even Naruto as well, because it's just so long, they break it down into like arcs or sagas. And I think even iPlayer breaks it into sagas rather than seasons.
Right.
And it even says such a saga coming on this day or coming soon.
Right, so they're releasing it in chunks.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Now, within 6 months of writing his hugely successful and award-winning career starter, Dr. Slump, Toriyama wanted to end the series, but publisher Shueisha would only allow it if he immediately started work on a second series for them instead. So Toriyama got to work. Working with his editor, Kazuhiko Torishima, Toriyama created multiple one-shots, but none of them were successful enough to warrant a series. Being a fan of Hong Kong and Chinese martial arts films, Toriyama turned to the movies of Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan for inspiration, and Dragon Boy, a two-part story published in Fresh Jump in 1983, was the result. Toriyama cited Drunken Master in particular as the main source of inspiration for the story about a young martial artist, as the fighting mixed with the light-hearted humour of the film was the perfect mix that he was after. Dragon Boy was a success, and so Dr. Slump could end. Its final panel, an invitation to what was to come next. See you in Dragon Ball. By the time Dragon Ball had started, though, it had already evolved into something drastically different from other manga of the time, as it was an adaptation of the famous Chinese story Journey to the West, albeit with more kung fu.
Monkey. When I was reading this, I thought, this is Monkey, complete with the cloud.
Yeah, yeah. The cloud and the staff.
Mm.
Toriyama liked the book, as the Chinese-inspired setting could set it apart from other Japanese manga, and it helped considerably that the epic tale of Wukong was also in the public domain. Replacing characters such as Sun Wukong, Tan Sanxing, and Zhu Baiji with his own, as well as altering Wukong's goal of collecting the ancient Buddhist text to something more closely resembling the epic Japanese novel Nanso Satomi Hakenden, in which the characters must collect 8 Buddhist pearls, Toriyama had perfectly distilled his shonen-friendly martial arts epic. Now, while Dragon Ball was, and still is, a huge success, it never left Japan until 1988, when the adaptation would debut in Hong Kong, and then in 1996, when it would debut in the US and the UK, in the slightly different form of Dragon Ball Z. Strangely, what would be the biggest contribution to Dragon Ball's global success was Dragon Ball Z, which isn't a sequel or a remake, but rather a reformatting of Dragon Ball anime that starts at chapter 195, with no allusion towards anything having come before it. So the previous 194 chapters were something a lot of the world wasn't aware of for a long time. But Dragon Ball Z is a story for another time, as we turn our gaze today on the Emperor Pilaf saga.
Right.
So that's why I'd never read Dragon Ball before.
Right.
Because for us, Dragon Ball didn't exist.
And only the cartoons that you watch were Dragon Ball Z.
So it's, oh yeah, it's only in Japan where Dragon Ball starts here and ends at the end of what we know as Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
For us, Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z are two completely different shows.
Right.
And Dragon Ball just didn't come over here at all.
Because this volume that you gave me, as well as what's his name, has what, about 36 tales in it? 35 tales in it?
Yeah.
Somewhere along that line.
It's kind of worth mentioning the format itself. So we're looking at this today in what's referred to as VizBig.
Yeah.
It's Viz's essentially deluxe edition. It's 3-in-1, or the last one I believe is 4-in-1, because they've printed it as Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z.
Mm.
So to keep it separate, they've had to merge one as a 4 rather than 3-in-1. It's the more expensive of the versions, but it's bigger art style. It's on matte white paper, so the artwork really kind of stands out. The colour pages are much better.
And there's not a lot of colour in it.
No.
There's only 2 chapters that have colour in it.
But it is the most censored of the 3. Now, you can't be a purist with Dragon Ball. Of the 3 versions, all of them are censored.
Hmm.
This is the most censored of the lot, and it's the more expensive as well. There's also the standard manga, which is probably your best way to kind of get into it. You know, the individual volumes.
Yeah.
Which I think is the least censored. And then you've got your standard 3-in-1s, which have very, very thin paper, so it makes it the cheaper option of the three. And it's also the only one that collects the entire run as Dragon Ball. So there's pros and cons to them. I just like this one because it's the bigger style and it's the more sturdy of the books. But these Vizbigs, I think they've done one for Vagabond as well and a couple of other things. So they're nice books.
Yeah, it's a lovely, it's a very handsome volume. Again, it's printed Eastern style. So yeah, you're reading it back to front from our point of view. But you get used to that pretty quickly. I do like that they have a little Goku on his cloud
telling you
at the top of every page which way to read it. Like you've forgotten in between pages. It was interesting that you gave us this and it's this big fat volume. And I love that you've put a trading card in where I have to stop reading. And it's a Maximum Carnage trading card.
I think it was the first one that fit. The first one that was there.
I don't know where you got that from. I must have had it somewhere.
I think you had it on the table, yeah.
Right, okay. And it was, overall, this is really charming.
Yeah. It's only the first saga that we're looking at. I mean, they're called sagas, just again, to break them up. It carries on going. And the more you read it, the more you kind of see that Toriyama was just making it up as he went along.
Yes. Very definitely when you get to the end.
Yeah.
Where, like, suddenly, all right, so Goku can suddenly turn into a monster when he looks at the moon.
But getting ahead of ourselves here.
Okay, well, you do the synopsis.
So just a kind of little bit of just to mention, you know, if anyone knows the Dragon Ball, because I grew up watching the TV show, those are the names that I know. So he's Master Roshi, it's the Flying Nimbus. In this, it's their actual Japanese names. So it's the Kintoon, it's Senen Kan, but it's I'm used to the cartoon names, so that's what they are.
Because there's a cast of characters thing at the beginning. So what, do they have different? So is Bulma not Bulma?
Yeah, so Bulma's Bulma.
All right.
The only ones that are slightly different, so you can see some of them, like Karirin is Krillin for us. So they kind of condense that down. He's called Master Roshi, but he's not called that in this. Just little names here and there.
Little changes.
Yeah. Son Goku is a strange young boy living alone deep in the forest since his grandfather passed away, killed one night by a mysterious giant beast. The only thing Goku has left of his grandfather is a strange four-star ball, completely unaware that it is one of the legendary Dragon Balls. Looking for the Dragon Balls is Bulma Briefs, who believes in the legends that whoever has all seven Dragon Balls will have their one wish granted by the mystical dragon, and so is journey across the country with a Dragon Ball tracker of her own making. Goku is reluctant to simply give away his granddad's ball, and so joins Bulma on her quest to find the rest. Aided by Goku's strange monkey tail and superhuman strength, the two have many adventures together, meeting along the way a shape-shifting pig, Oolong, the roguish desert bandit Yamcha, and his companion Puar, and even finding Master Roshi, the famed turtle hermit master of Kung Fu who taught Goku's grandfather how to fight. Their search ultimately leads them into the hands of the evil Emperor Pilaf. Already in possession of a Dragon Ball, Bulma's tracker leads them right into his palace, where they're captured and have the balls taken from them. Pilaf, Dragon Balls assembled, summons the Dragon God, but before he can make his wish to rule the world, it's stolen from him by Oolong, who desperately managed to escape his imprisonment just in time to wish for a pair of girls' pants. Before the dusk has settled, the moon shines brightly in the night sky and triggers something inside Goku. The party soon realise that Goku, without knowing, was the monster that killed his granddad, and he grows into a giant ape. Believing his tail to be the source of the power, Yamcha and Puar desperately cut it off. Thankfully, they're correct in their hunch, and Goku returns to his normal self, fast asleep and unaware of the dark monster inside him. With their quest complete, the gang say their farewells, and maybe they'll meet again one day. But for now, Goku must travel back to Master Roshi to train just like his grandfather did.
If his power's in his tail and they cut his tail off at the end, why is he still super strong?
Because he is super strong.
And that's nothing to do with his tail?
That's nothing to do with his tail. He grows his tail back anyway.
Oh, right.
And comes back and then gets cut off again and then it comes back again.
Okay, fair enough. Because that seemed like a good way of doing
it. And then later on, because Gohan has a tail as well, so when the moon comes out, Gohan turns into a giant ape. And because Goku's dead at this point, Piccolo, who's training Gohan, has no idea what to do. So he blows up the moon.
But Goku gets better, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. Goku dies like 5 times. Oh, Goku's died more than Sam and Dean combined.
That's... and Buffy.
Yeah.
All right, that's fair enough. The first thing, I didn't know what I was expecting of this.
Yeah.
Because my memory of you liking it as a kid is that Dragon Ball Z is relatively serious.
Dragon Ball Z, where it evolves, and it's why I wanted to cover the first story arc of Dragon Ball Z as well, is Dragon Ball Z is a superhero comic.
Yeah.
Whereas this...
is a fantasy.
Yeah, and it wears its Journey to the West adventure on its sleeve so much more. Like, it is much more lighthearted. Dragon Ball will always retain kind of a lighthearted earnestness to it.
Yes.
But, yeah, Z is definitely much more, not mature, but it's a different tone to what is we see here.
Yeah, this is very definite. It's slightly weird. In that I was quite surprised to see full frontal nudity from Goku.
Yeah.
But he's a kid.
There's quite a lot of it, and it's kind of, I think there's a degree of adjusting to the kind of context. Yeah. So, like, these are kids at the end of the day, but they're all flashing each other. Goku's walking around with his todger out. Mm.
But there's an innocence to it.
Yeah, yeah.
That, like, he's not naked for any salacious reasons. He's naked because he's fishing.
Yeah.
And it's his tail that attracts the fish.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, he's took all his clothes off to drop his fish in the water.
Yeah.
Fish. His tail in the water to attract the fish that he then kicks
yeah.
to knock it out. And then he just walks home with his dinner.
Yeah.
Basically. And the thing I liked about Goku in this, he is just so adorably innocent.
Yeah.
And sweet throughout this entire strip.
He's just kind of pure of heart. Which yeah. They kind of lean into, like, he's the only one who can ride the flying Nimbus.
He's the only one who can ride the flying Nimbus, yeah. And he's got the expendable stick.
Yeah.
That does have a proper name. He meets Bulma, who I thinks she's more attractive than she actually is.
Yes.
Is that part of her character yes. thing? Because she's only supposed to be 16.
Bulma's great in that she's probably one of my favourite characters because she's a horrible person, but again, she's just so endearing. She thinks herself highly than she is. There's times when you can tell that she gets put into situations just so Toriyama can draw her in different outfits.
Yeah.
But she's also a genius. She's also, you know, she solves problems. She created the Dragon Tracker. There's enough character for her to kind of balance it out.
Yeah. And I like that at the beginning she's manipulating Goku into helping her.
Yeah.
But as the story goes along, she actually grows to quite like him. I love those little pocket things.
The capsules.
That become yeah. other things.
So I think a lot of this comes from Dr. Slump, because there is some crossover between the two. They're set in the same place. Later on in Dragon Ball, they meet the characters. But in a lot of Toriyama's work, they just have the capsule pods. Because I think they're kind of convenient from a storytelling point of view, so he just keeps bringing them up and reusing them.
Mm. At the beginning as well, it's only Goku and Bulma.
Yeah.
The adventures that they get into are a little bit more frivolous and fun.
Yeah.
And there's moments as well, Goku gets tied to a tree and he's like, why has he tied me to a tree?
Yeah.
He's just so innocent throughout this entire strip that makes it fun. But then you've got little bits like, Goku's not entirely sure what a woman is.
Yeah.
And to see what a woman is, he plays Pat-Pat.
Yes.
Which he basically just pats the crotch of everybody he meets to say, oh, so you're a man.
Yeah.
All right, and you're a woman.
And it's one of those things, you know, it's not exactly... You have to kind of contextualize it because, you know, it's not exactly from a modern read and there's probably people who kind of have problems with that kind of thing. But it's because of its earnest innocence... that Goku is just this recluse. He doesn't know what anything is. He has to kind of learn one way or another. And yet, him patting people on the crotch is genuinely funny. It is.
Yeah, there's a carry-on nudge-nudge, wink-wink vibe to it that carries the humour of it, even when it gets a little bit salacious.
And it never kind of falls completely into that territory. Even when you get to Master Roshi, who's constantly perving, he's always the butt of the joke, though.
Well, you've got this thing here that he says that he slept on his granddad, who was a bit bumpier.
Yeah.
And you suddenly realise that he slept on his granddad's balls.
They're cuddled up together.
Well, okay, so he takes Bulmia's panties off her.
Yeah.
While she's asleep.
To check if there's anything there.
To try and get comfy.
Yeah.
And get to sleep himself. And he's like, but there's nothing here. How am I supposed to get comfy?
And I do like how grossed out he is by it as well.
By the fact that there's nothing there. But she doesn't know he's done this.
Because she was asleep.
And later on in the story, who is it who asks
she
to see...
She flashes Master Roshi.
It's Master Roshi, yeah.
Because
the hermit crap.
Pants.
All he wants to do is see a girl's panties again, because he hasn't seen... So she flashes him.
Yeah.
But she's not wearing anything.
But she doesn't
but
know
But she
that.
Doesn't know she's not wearing anything. And again, there's a part that's like, I'm not sure about this. But it's all played with such humour.
Yeah.
And so straight face, and the art is so adorable. Like, Goku's facial expressions is brilliant.
Yeah.
We've talked before about, there is a very noted comic book artist who doesn't work for DC much anymore, who slagged off manga, and he would do that to get engagement, because that's what he did.
Yeah.
But the art in this is so much more pleasing than anything he's ever done.
Yeah.
And so much better storytelling. And yet you can, again, you can go big eyes and all that gubbins and speed lines. But the art in this is actually genuinely very impressive.
Yeah, we're still in the period here as well where we've gone out of the colour.
Mm.
But even still, it's there's watercolour inks and grey tones. We've not moved into complete black and white just yet. It's really nice. Obviously, you know, one of the god is one of the best manga artists, but there's just the storytelling and the pacing just works completely. And it's these first few stories are kind of, each chapter is like a mini adventure within a larger adventure.
And it does a great job of introducing the characters as you go along.
Yeah.
So that it initially starts, it's just Goku and Bulmia. And then as it goes along, when she realizes that she flashed him with nothing on, is genuinely funny.
Yeah.
And you don't know that it should be.
Yeah.
I love the art as well when they're angry, that their mouths become like crocodile jaws. Yeah. That's absolutely beautiful.
I do love the running gag as well, because Goku lived on his own for so long. You've got these big monsters. And the world itself, I think, deserves a mention. So we've got anthropomorphized animals.
Mm.
We've got dinosaurs all kind of in this world, and it all just kind of works, you just accept it.
Hmm.
But also there's this running gag as well that you've got these big monsters and these big henchmen who challenge Goku. Goku's just a kid, he can't be that strong, right?
Yeah.
But Goku doesn't know how strong he is because he doesn't have a point of reference.
Hmm.
So he just kicks the crap out of them just without breaking a sweat.
Yeah, and he never really does it in any malicious way.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, right, I've got to fight this guy now.
Yeah.
And he just does it.
There's a great bit when we get to the fighting tournament in the next story arc that we're not going to talk about, where he just beats the crap out of anyone. And there's a throwaway gag, which is genius, where this guy's like, that fighting style, I've never seen it before. What is it? Huh, I don't have a fighting style.
Yeah, and he doesn't.
Yeah.
And the second story is the tracking the Dragon Balls across where they're going. I was very impressed as well that this entire story tells that story. The end of this, the Dragon Balls are all found and they all go about the separate ways.
Yeah.
And it's one of those where you're like, well, they've not contrived a way to keep all these characters together.
Yeah.
Now, I presume some of them will come back and some, but as the point of the story is gone,
yeah,
they've written them out.
Well, it's this long story, but they do kind of come in and fall out and fall in. So where I'm up to later on, it's just Goku, Krillin and Bulma. So they kind of mix and match.
Mm.
Like by the time you get up to Dragon Ball Z, you've got such a huge cast of characters. They kind of swap in and out and there's multiple subplots. But for this, it's just building that momentum. So in this one here, you know, we're in a town that's haunted by this monster Oolong who's stealing everyone's daughters.
And it turns out he's just a little pig.
Yeah.
Who can transform into other things. But he can only stay transformed for, what is it, an hour?
3 minutes or something like that.
And then he has to wait a certain amount of time before he can do it again.
Which, again, you're like, oh yeah, that must be a shapeshifter thing.
Mm.
When you meet Pua later on, who went to the same shapeshifting school, they can transform for better because they paid attention in class and Oolong was oogling girls.
Yeah, and he goes through this and he is a pig.
Yes.
Literally.
Yeah. Read him with Danny DeVito's voice as well.
It says here, he can change into absolutely anything he wants, but only for 5 minute periods. And then it takes a full minute for him to recharge in between transformations. And you've got the whole thing, where does the extra mask come from? Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody gives a shit.
You've got this great bit here where he keeps transforming into different things and Goku just keeps breaking them all every time.
Yeah.
And then the payoff is we get we go to we've defeated Oolong.
Yeah.
We go to his lair to rescue the girls, and they're all living a life of luxury. Yeah. As just, you know, lying around. They want to stay here rather than going back to the poor village.
All the girls that he's kidnapped have actually took control of him.
Yeah.
And are essentially bossing him around.
Yeah.
And have got this perfect life. So he ends up going with Goku and Bulma because he's not bothered.
Yeah. Toriyama does a really good job of that. Every time you have someone who leans a bit too far in the kind of salacious area, he pulls them back and he makes them the butt of the joke. And then so he kind of gives himself a get out of jail free card, essentially, because he tells you that these are still bad people, but we can laugh at them.
Yes. I love the name Fry Pan Mountain, which I think is delightful. I love that Goku at one point says, are we there yet?
Yeah,
because he is only still a kid,
and I love that Goku's just along for the ride. None of this means anything to him. He's just out for the adventure,
and purely because he didn't want to give his Dragon Ball up to this strange girl.
Yeah,
and he's not got a vested interest in any of this.
And you get some really sweet moments like that, where this is his last memento of his granddad, so he doesn't want to give this up because he can't. For him, this is all he knows. His granddad's all he knows, and he can't see this bigger world because he lived in this small shack. And you get some really sweet moments, especially later on, where after someone's made a wish, the Dragon Balls go their separate ways. He makes sure he jumps up so he can catch his granddad's ball before it can disappear.
But it's just a stone now.
Yeah.
It's not the Dragon Ball.
Well, it takes time to recharge.
Yeah, it's about a year.
Yeah.
And they'll become the Dragon Balls again. This didn't make sense to me. He gives her a candy. Bulma gives Oolong a candy so that she can do suey, like they do with pigs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that gives him the trots. But later on, he just seems to happen to him and he's not eating anything.
No, she makes like a pig squeal and he poos himself on command.
Yeah.
So she kind of does it to just keep blackmailing him.
And what I did like about this, she loses all of her capsules.
Yeah.
So she can't make her bike or make her house or what anything. So she gets Oolong to change into a little moped, but he's still Oolong.
So it collapses.
So he can't support her weight.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite interesting, because that does go into the words, all the extra mass go. And Oolong's Pigsy.
Yeah.
From Monkey.
Right, yeah.
And she's Tripitaka.
Yeah.
And Goku is Monkey.
Yeah.
And it is a literal translation of that exact same story that Monkey was doing as well.
He's just filled in the... I mean, that's why he's called Son Goku, Son Wukong.
Yeah.
It's very definitely at the forefront. And then we meet Yamcha. Now, Yamcha's great. The thing with Yamcha is...
He's not great in this story, though, is he?
He's great.
Is he?
I love Yamcha. Yeah. The thing is, I knew Yamcha as the loser who dies in Dragon Ball Z.
Hmm.
He dies, like, right off the bat. And, like, for a generation of people, like myself, Yamcha was a joke. Because he was the first one to just be mercilessly killed. It was actually really refreshing coming back here and seeing him as this fully fleshed out character that we didn't know existed.
Yeah, he was actually quite competent until he meets girls.
And yeah.
And it's like his kryptonite is girl. He can't talk to him.
Yeah.
He just blushes wildly whenever he's in the presence.
And I just love the kind of problem they have with each other, and that he massively fancies Bulma.
Hmm.
Bulma massively fancies him, but neither of them can speak to each other.
Yeah, it was borderline ridiculous. I love the fight where Goku just says, go stick, go, and it grows and knocks him out. And it's none of them are expecting how good Goku is at this stuff, because even he's not sure. And even Goku, though, he gets weak whenever he's hungry.
And he gets hungry all the time.
Yeah, and he's hungry all the time because he's a kid.
Yeah.
And kids are hungry all the time. And there's just so many cool little moments, like Fist of the Wolf Fang. I love Puar.
Puar's great, yeah.
The little cat.
Yeah.
I presume it's a cat.
A shape-shifting cat.
But the cat can shape-shift as well. There's so much to it that you think is Deus Ex Machina, but it works really well and doesn't come across as that.
I do love the bit where they're in the desert and they're in the van. And
how can Yamcha... you eat so much? Because I'm hungry.
Yamcha sneaks in to steal the Dragon Ball while they're sleeping, but Oolong is in disguise as Bulma instead. But he manages to convince everyone, despite the fact that Bulma is now short and stubby.
Yeah. And well, later on, when she makes a deal with the Turtle King...
Yeah.
To... What does he ask for? He asks to see her chest, doesn't he?
Yes.
Which is a bit gross.
Yeah.
But she's not wanting to go through it, so she makes Oolong change into her, and he becomes the short and stubby one again. And she's like, have you ever seen me? And she makes him be taller and thinner.
Yeah.
And he's complaining because that takes more out of him.
Yeah.
To be able to do his shape changing. So I thought that was quite funny.
It's just one of those really interesting kind of depths of his character, and that, yes, he's a shapeshifter, but he's a lazy, inept shapeshifter.
Yeah, he's a lazy get. And he's just baffled by the fact that he's just touched a pair of woman's boobs. And Puar's like, just don't think about them, lot.
Yeah. Do you get... Toriyama gets a lot of mileage out of the whole double entendre of the balls.
Yeah.
And you'd think it would stop getting funny, but it doesn't.
No, it's never not funny. He ends up... Bulmia ends up in a Playgirl outfit. A Playgirl bunny outfit.
She loses her clothes, and the only thing that Oolong has lying around
is a Playgirl bunny outfit, which initially I was like, I texted you, where did you get this from?
Yeah.
What's that all about? But later on, they go to a town that is being terrorized by the bunny bunch or something.
Yeah.
And so they start respecting her because she's wearing this Playboy bunny outfit.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know why they're giving her stuff for free, and the car needs filling up with petrol, they give it for free.
Yeah.
She goes shopping and everything's free.
And then the second she takes it off...
Well, she takes off the Playgirl bunny outfit and buys some proper food, some proper clothes, sorry. And then they start respecting her.
Yeah.
And then they show up, the actual bunny gang show up.
He's terrifying. Like, the fact that he touches you and you turn into a carrot.
Yeah. But that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then they come across this poor dinosaur that they just decapitate.
Yeah, so...
Which I feel a bit sorry for the dinosaur.
I mean, this is quite a neat little bit as well. I mean,
With
Chi-Chi. I mean, this gets more important because Goku just makes a throwaway line where he promises to marry Chi-Chi. Hmm. That pays off because Goku then has to come back and marry Chi-Chi.
Yeah, and he's not even aware of what he's saying.
Yeah.
He doesn't care. He doesn't really know what marriage is, does he?
And it's one of those things that's a testament to Goku's character. Is he does fulfil his promise and the pair of them stay happily married.
Oh, right, okay.
But all of this is just great stuff with Fire Mountain and with Chi-Chi as well. And it's just really... I mean, it's here where you can kind of start to see the threads join a bit more. Mm. Yamcha's still following them. You get Chi-Chi. We have to go back.
Yamcha follows them all the way through and then eventually has to get involved with the story.
Yeah.
And so he's following them because his plan is when they get all of the Dragon Balls, he's just going to steal them off them.
Which ultimately happens to them anyway, but not from Yamcha
because they get kidnapped by somebody else. But again, just look at the facial expressions when he's, I will take them with my fist. He's so cocky without actually realizing how he's cocky. I thought Chi-Chi was going to be in this a lot more than she was.
Because, not at this point, yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. In the cast of characters thing at the beginning, she's mentioned as a central character, but she isn't. I do like where the old guy lives.
The Kame house on his little island.
He's got a little house on a little island with turtles, and I don't know why he wants to live. But they take him away because he's the only person who can put out the flame on the mountain.
Which he does with the Kamehame wave.
Yeah, but he does that in exchange for seeing Bulmia's boobs. Yeah. Which seems a little bit, you know. But you said all of that's censored in this.
So it's mostly censored in... This is the most censored. So there's, for example, there's a bit where she's pulling a top down, right?
Yeah.
In this, her hand covers her boob.
Yeah.
In other versions, you see the boob. It's smooth, but it's boob.
Right.
Which is why it was strange to watch the anime on Crunchyroll, which you'd expect to be censored, but isn't.
Yeah, you'd think that but was it since... Well, they never showed this on Toonami, did they?
No.
They only showed Dragon Ball Z.
Which, there are three different versions of Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
All owned by different distributors.
Like, there's three different versions of Gatchaman. Yeah,
but all of them are the same, but they're all dubbed different. So there's different versions of them. But yeah, Master Roshi here shows everyone that he's incredibly strong by doing the Kamehame wave.
Hmm.
Great bit as well, where he's like, no one can do this, I'm the only one, and Goku just does it without trying.
Yeah, which was quite funny. But he does put out the flame, the fires on the mountains, but he also destroys their houses.
The mountain.
So they're all like, well, we can just rebuild, so it's fine. So that's that one mission over, they get another Dragon Ball. Because he just does the Kamehame wave on the car, doesn't he, and breaks the car.
But then... The gag with that is they don't have a car now.
Yeah. So now they've got to walk.
There's a great throwaway line where I think Bulma calls Goku some kind of alien.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, at this point, Goku's just a kid. He actually is an alien, but we just don't know that yet.
Yes.
And it's a testament to how good of a storyteller Toriyama is that for us, because it happens in the very first episode or a chapter of Dragon Ball Z, you just accept that he's an alien. In this, he's not. So imagine you're reading a comic, right, for 195 chapters, and then there's a plot twist that your main character is actually an alien.
Yeah, it was called Highlander 2. We hated it. I love the vehicles as well.
The vehicle designs are great, yeah.
Yeah, the vehicle designs are brilliant. I presume this is very toyetic. I presume there's an awful lot of toys that you can buy from this.
Oh, yeah.
This is it. This is the story where they rock up at this town because they've no fuel. So they have to go and get some petrol from somewhere. And she's got the Playboy Bunny outfit and everyone's terrified of her. And one of the things that he mentions in the interview at the back was it isn't Japan, but it kind of is.
It's if China and Japan kind of merged together.
Yeah, it's a stylized version of it so he can do what he wants.
Yeah.
But they really look like they're in the Middle East here.
Yes. And it's one of those things that he does really well as the further you get onto it as well as he starts bringing in. For us, it's different continents, but for here, it's all quite close-knitted.
Yeah.
So you get more kind of indigenous people, you get more very definitely American people, and he does a really good job of just merging all these things together. Some of these depictions, I mean, it was the mid-80s, some of these depictions kind of border on the racist. So in certain more modern reprints, they've had to tweak the artwork to tone that down a bit.
Yeah.
But he does, the cast is very, very diverse. And especially will he just throw in, like, Manba as well. Like, he'll just throw stuff in. You just accept it. There's a town that's just full of giant mushrooms. You just accept it.
Well, yeah, as you go along, you've just got to kind of throw away the idea that logic is going to play any part in this.
Yeah.
And you are going to come across this gangland leader who looks like a rabbit who can turn people into carrots.
Yeah.
But if you've bought into it at this point, this isn't any more ridiculous than anything else. And I do like that he doesn't even fight with Bulma. He's just like, do you want to press the flesh? And he turns her into a carrot.
Yeah.
And everyone's gutted by that. Particularly Yamcha. Is that his name?
Yamcha.
Yeah. Who, like, wants her to be a girl again. And so the fight scenes are just really kinetic.
Yes, yeah.
Goku's more interesting in the fighting because, like you say, he doesn't know why he's good at it, so he doesn't have a particular style.
Yeah.
So you get the feeling that he's literally making everything up as he goes along.
Yeah.
Which makes it a bit more interesting than he's just doing jiu-jitsu or he's just doing this or whatever.
And it's more, the more Toriyama leaned in, it's what he wanted to do in the first place. He wanted to do the kung fu and the fighting. And especially the more you kind of get into it, the more it becomes about that. But then, again, because Toriyama's making up, just when it becomes too much of a martial arts comic, we'll get on another adventure or the Dragon Balls would activate again and we've got to go find them again.
And then we get into the final story, which is where they finally track down the final set of Dragon Balls.
That the Emperor Pilaf has.
And all of a sudden, because I texted you about this as we were all of a sudden they start just breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Which they haven't really done throughout. They start referring to Professor Slump.
Yes.
Which was the previous comic strip.
Because they start doing poo jokes, which was what Dr. Slump was famous for, doing poo jokes. So they kind of actually go, no, we're not doing this again.
Yes. And if you think we'll pander to our audience's shameful love of PP caca humour simply to boost the sales of this Dragon Ball comic. And you're like, so does he know he's in a comic?
Yeah. It's a lot of kind of manga kind of do that, play a bit fast and loose. And I think, again, it's just because of the light-hearted tone and nature of it, you can just do it and then you'll move on past it. And it's so fast and kinetic.
And because they never do it again.
Yeah.
It is literally that one page. She makes a joke about, well, where can the balls be? And she says, well, maybe in between the man's legs.
Yeah.
And he's like, we're not having none of that. Stop that filth. We're not Dr. Slump.
Yeah.
And it does say, it gives you a little footnote at the bottom what Dr. Slump was. I presume that's not there in the original manga.
Well, I don't, it could have been. And again, I think it's that kind of context of when you're reading this new, you were only reading this because you probably read Dr. Slump beforehand. And it's just, this has vastly overshadowed Dr. Slump now. Yeah. It's quite interesting. What's interesting here, though, is that, again, Toriyama has a habit of making things up. But when he went back to work on the anime, Pilaf is set up much earlier. So Pilaf is trying to find the Dragon Balls as Goku's trying to find the Dragon Balls. So here it's very sudden. Pilaf's just in it and he's the big bad guy.
Yeah.
Whereas kind of going back and having that hindsight, he worked Pilaf in a lot earlier in the cartoon.
See, is that where she should have flipped in the bird and doesn't?
Yes.
So yeah. They've changed the artwork there, and that's where Pilaf leans into, oh, so you like humiliating, you're ready to talk.
I do love that Pilaf's form of torture is, and it's built up as well, like, oh, what is he going to do? It's horrific, and he blows her a kiss.
Yeah, and like she says, I thought you were going to strip me nude and do slurp, slurp, or puff, puff, or pat, pat, or even grope, grope. And Pilaf's like, horrified. How can you think? What a diseased mind. Because you've kind of got, they're playing with the idea, though, that Bulmer may have enjoyed that.
Or at the very least, that Bulmer kind of knows what this is.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
We're up against something far more terrible than we've imagined. And it's like, I got the impression Pilaf was just supposed to be a child.
Mm.
And he's not really, and he's not even very good at this supervillainy stuff. Because he knocks himself out with his own snooze gas.
Yeah.
Which was very, very funny. It's like, oh, he forgot to put his gas mask on. You're like, what an idiot.
And I just love, though, that you've got this big bad guy.
Who's crap.
Or at least the first one, who kind of is a subversion of his own tropes.
Yeah.
He's very much a stereotypical bad guy, but every time he does a stereotypical bad guy thing, it's the like the opposite of what you'd expect.
Yeah. And he gets all the Dragon Balls. He succeeds in getting all the Dragon Balls and summons the Dragon God. And Oolong leaps in before he can make his wish. And all he wishes for is a pair of girls' panties.
And it's an absolutely great sequence of Shenron being summoned.
The panties of a hot babe.
And it's great.
And it's like,
this is what saves the day.
And like Dragon looks at him like, really?
But
the entire quest is for Bulmer to have a boyfriend.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you not just get yourself? Why do you need the Dragon Balls?
She ends
for this
up doing anyway because she gets the amateur.
Yeah.
But this is kind of, I think, a victim of mistranslation as well.
Mm.
He wishes, in the original text, he wishes for a pair of comfortable pants.
Right.
But because it's Oolong, the pants that he's thinking of are girls' pants.
Right.
So it grants his wish, but not the wish that he made.
It's not a literal wish for a pair of girls' pants.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
And then the Dragon Balls all go away. And then this sequence, I think, is genuinely kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, and sweet.
Where Goku, he's already mentioned that his granddad was killed by this monster.
Mm.
And he turns into the monster. And I think it's just this really sweet moment where they all make the conscious decision to never tell Goku who he is.
Not tell him that this is what he does and he's killed his own grandparent. And there's an element of tragedy there that the strip hasn't lent into in any way.
Yeah.
It has mostly been like a comical farce with a carry-on level of humour to it. And that's actually quite, it is quite a sad ending.
It just kind of shows you, I think, just how good of a storyteller Toriyama was, because he just brings this out and it just adds this bit more weight to it. And it doesn't happen often, but every once in a while, and especially more and more further on, you just get these really sweet character moments.
And does he ever turn into a big monkey again?
Don't believe Goku ever. Yes, Goku does.
Because surely you must see the moon again at some point.
Yeah. So we cut the tail off and then the tail does come back later on. And we do play around with the giant monkey a bit.
Right.
But I just love this whole sequence of just him growing bigger and bigger.
Becoming
and
Kong.
I think, again, it adds more weight to Goku's character. He's this really sweet, innocent child who's incredibly naive and he's pure of heart. But he's also a monster capable of committing mass destruction.
Mm.
It's you know, kind of like a Peter Parker Spider-Man thing. He's got two polar opposites, and he's or Jekyll and Hyde. Like, he's completely unaware of either.
Oh, it is, and it's quite sweet. And then the ending's quite sad as well, where they all decide, well, we're going to go our separate ways now.
Yeah.
She tells him that for a year, the Dragon Balls will just be stones.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about it. But after a year, they'll turn back into the Dragon Balls.
Yeah.
And you can collect them again. So Bulmer gives Goku her tracking device.
Yeah.
Because she's decided, well, I've got what I wanted. I've got a boyfriend. So I don't need the Dragon Balls anymore.
And also, Goku wants his granddad's ball back. So he needs to go and find it.
Yeah, he wants the thing back that connects him with his grandparent. And that it all ends with them just saying bye to each other. They flip off in separate ways. Oolong goes with those two.
Mm.
Goku just goes off on his own. And I was, if I'd had the time, I would have carried on reading it and seeing what the next story was. Because it seemed, but I ran out of time before we recorded, but it seems like the art style is quite different in the second story, or the third volume.
Yeah.
Essentially, the first story is the first two volumes, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the third volume is another story. And is this the only story?
No. So this is, he goes back to train with Master Roshi.
Hmm.
Krillin shows up. And then they train and get entered into the Budokai Tenkaichi tournament.
Right.
That's the big chunk of the next story, them fighting in this tournament.
Right.
And that's where it becomes this more martial arts thing. And then, yeah, they have to go back and find the Dragon Balls again. So it's all just great examples of Toriyama storytelling. And Goku's equally adorable when he's fighting in this tournament because he's really good, but he doesn't know why.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, at this point as well, it's one of those great moments where you can kind of stop reading it now. They've done what they set out to
do. It's a complete story.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to read it because I wanted to see what happened to Goku. And Bulmia must show up again because she's there at the end.
And it's a great... You know, we know that we've got great characters here when they just come back and we instantly know who we are. Or you can have story arcs that have nothing to do with... In fact, I mentioned Goku dies several times and it focuses on the other cast. Dragon Ball genuinely does have one of the biggest cast lists, but also the most interesting at the same time.
Yeah. And it's quite interesting. There's a little bit of what's the battles are about to get. All hail our Tenkaichi Budokai Challengers. That's very video game.
Well, they named the video games after it, the Budokai Tenkaichi.
Right. A very Scott Pilgrim as well. So you can see where Scott Pilgrim was getting some of his ideas from.
You can definitely see just how influential this is. Kind of going back and seeing the original context, you can kind of see what everything else was influenced by. I think why this holds up so much is because, you know, there is a lot of things where you don't enjoy them or they're not as good as they should be because everything else came after it, wanted to be it.
Yeah.
So it can kind of take away from what made it so special.
Mm.
This still feels fresh.
Yeah.
Even now, even 30 years later, this still feels fresh and modern and exciting and captivating. And not a lot of things can say that.
No. I loved it. I genuinely did love it. I was dead impressed with it. Because I sat down to read it and like, I don't really know what I'm going to get here.
Yeah.
And then when you settle into, all right, it's a comedy.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah.
Then you settle into it and it's just, it's so endearing and so charming and so fun and so fresh and the art's lovely and the characters are great.
Yeah.
Even, like you say, even the slightly sleazy ones, you like them.
Yeah.
We like Oolong.
And they're not, the thing with it is they aren't bad guys.
No.
And as we get in, and the series will evolve, especially when we get to Dragon Ball Z, and you can kind of see why they made Dragon Ball Z a separate thing.
Mm.
Tonally, it's different.
Yeah.
It is a superhero story. It's why I wanted to kind of do it as another show as well, because just to show the contrast and where it would evolve.
Mm.
But it's just so fresh and fun, and it's just, there's nothing else like it, and there's a reason why it has remained. There's a reason why it's as huge as it is.
Mm.
There's a reason why we're still doing it. It's just been announced. The release date for the next show is coming out. It's the last one that Toriyama worked on.
Yeah.
Is coming out soon. Like, there's a reason why it's still a huge thing.
Yeah. Good. No, I genuinely did love it. I genuinely enjoyed it.
My biggest surprise was that Dana enjoyed it as much as she would. Usually she just kind of lets me put on whatever and she zones out, but she actually enjoyed Dragon Ball.
Right. Maybe I'll watch a couple on Crunchyroll. Okay, that's about wraps it up for Dragon Ball. Well done. Good synopsis.
Yes.
I liked your background. We've got another email from Tom Panarese. Hello, Leylands. Hello, Tom. It's been great to hear you guys again, and I've been meaning to reach out and email the show, but life keeps getting in the way, and I'm very, very lazy.
That's fine. Yep.
Anyway, I was excited to hear that you're covering the Catwoman Lonely City series. I've been a fan of Cliff Chang since he was the artist on Brian Azzarello's Wonder Woman run in the New 52. And he was the lone highlight of that Wonder Woman run. And absolutely loved Paper Girls. Oh, I've thought about checking out Paper Girls. Because didn't that become a TV series for like 10 minutes?
Yes. Yeah.
Was it on Netflix?
I don't know, it was on something.
So it's cancelled now then. the series didn't disappoint, even though it did take a long time to come out. DC's Black Label was something I ignored when it first started up, mainly because I wasn't interested in what seemed to be an excuse to show bat nudity and lots of swearing. I picked up a couple of the non-superhero comics at one point or another and didn't dive into the books until Wonder Woman Dead Earth dropped in 2019-2020. I found that to be really solid and really liked the square-bound format. It reminded me of the graphic novels that DC and Marvel put out in the early to mid-1980s, like X-Men's God Love Man Kills and Jack Kirby's Hunger Dogs. I've been able to buy a number of those old graphic novels for cheap on the back issue market, and well, there's a reason they're cheap, but some of them are absolutely gorgeous. As for the Black Label book, I have liked them, more or less. Their own stories, because I like picking and choosing what I want to spend that much money on. I bought Aquaman Andromeda by Ram V and Christian Ward on a whim, and it turned out to be better than I expected. Harleen, which I read on the DC Infinite app, was interesting, but read kind of like fan fiction. So I'm glad I didn't pay for the physical issues. But the art on that is the guy who does the bondage comic.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So what's his name?
I know who it is.
Yeah, but... Stefan something or other.
Yeah, yeah.
So the art looks like it's going to be good.
But also, he made his name doing
Sunspot.
Yeah, so it kind of is fan fiction, though. Yeah. So that's probably why it reads like
that. I've always been interested in that just because I like the art. I think he's got a really nice art style.
Yeah.
Because I've read some Sunspot as well.
Right.
Which is literally about people who love bondage. That's what the comic's about. So his art style's quite interesting. If there's two Black Label series that are musts, I would recommend John Ridley's The Other History of the DC Universe, which is formatted similar to the classic Wolfman Perez History of the DCU, but told through the eyes of a number of DC's non-white characters. It's absolutely outstanding. That sounds interesting, doesn't it? As is Wonder Woman Historia, which told the history of the Amazons. That one was written by Kelly Sue DeConnick and had three separate artists on each of its three issues. Phil Jimenez, Gene Hart and Nicholas Scott. It's flat out gorgeous, even if it is a pretty dense history. You lent me them three.
Yeah.
They're on that bookshelf there. I've not yet got around to reading them, I probably will.
I was looking forward to them for a long time because I know Jimenez was sharing a lot of his work, and I think the book took a long time to come out because of him.
Yeah,
but that ended up being one where the art's great. I didn't care for the story as much.
All right, okay.
But it's very dense.
Right. So I applaud DC for at least allowing me to be choosy here and rewarding me when I am. I'm glad you like the Catwoman series, and I'm looking forward to see what else you two have in store. Best, Tom. Well, thank you very much, Tom, and it's nice to hear from you again.
Mm-hmm.
There was another Black Label, I think, that I was interested in. I liked the one Dan Jurgens did with Mike Perkins.
Right.
Batman First Night, that was good. And there was another one that's... Superman. The Last Days of Superman by Mark Waid and Brian Hitch.
Oh, is that...
One issue has thus come out. Right. And I asked Mike Bailey, what's going on with this?
Yeah.
Because Brian Hitch told me at either Thought Bubble or The Lakes, I can't remember which one, but it's going on 2 or 3 years ago now, that he'd done the first two issues.
Right.
They were done and dusted and in the drawer. And he was waiting on Mark Waid for the third script.
Right.
For issue three. So I don't know what the delay is with that one, because I was interested in that one.
Yeah.
Because Brian Hitch's favourite character is Superman.
Yeah.
So he's always wanted to do a big Superman project. And it seems like it's been disappointing to him for some reason.
I forgot that one came out, but now I know why I've forgotten.
Yeah,
that
issue one came out, and then they've never solicited two or three.
Right.
And he did complain that he didn't want that. He wanted him only to solicit when all three have done.
Mm.
And apparently Mark Waid is the same. So whatever the delay is, it's neither one of them wanted the first issue out until it was completely finished.
Yeah.
But I can understand DC wanting to make their money back. Anyway, thank you to everybody who emailed in this week. Thank you to everyone who continues to listen. Buy us a coffee if you want to, as mentioned in the end credits. I know that it's a what's it time, isn't it? What's it called? A cost of greed crisis.
Cost of greed?
It's not a cost of living crisis. It's the companies are posting massive profits. That's all I'm going to say on that subject. Yeah. We'll be back next time with an all new episode where we'll be looking at... What are we doing? Oh!
Bond.
We've been expecting you, Mr. Bond. Finally, we're doing the James Bond show. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to you reading them and seeing what you think of them. And exactly 90 minutes, we rock.
We're good at this.
Well, not on the last episode, we won't. We'll see you next time. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland.
All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to him. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/A-Leyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, coming in your ears. It's a date.